If it's happening now, we're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Major Tom McKay is on the board. Wild Will Erskine booking the guests. And the legendary CHML newsroom, Dave Woodard and Jennifer McQueen. Here's Scott Thompson.
It is Hamilton Today. I'm Scott Thompson, 900 CHML. Let's do this first. Open Streets Hamilton will return this year. Here's the CHML X poll of the day. Open Streets Hamilton returns this year. Do you think the city of Hamilton should designate one or two downtown streets as pedestrian only? What do we got here? I think 62% said yes. Which, you know, I'm kind of surprised, but I'm quite hopeful. And, you know, just because you've got a, you're doing this doesn't mean you do it for the whole length of the city, the whole length of the street, the whole whatever. Many cities that have done this, I mean, it's just a couple of block space. We're usually in around a downtown hospitality or entertainment district or what have you. So, you know, I think that Hamilton certainly has the capability of doing that. But, you know, it's funny. It's like people in, for example, Amsterdam, you can't ride your bikes in Amsterdam. Or sorry, your car, drive your car is only all bikes. And it's like, yeah, in the downtown core in a very, very small area, there are restrictions for that. But, you know, if you're driving to the airport, it's just like going to the airport here. So, you know, again, the devil's in the details here. And let's not look at this as one extreme or the other. And is there a compromise? Is there a great way to do this? Absolutely. And about 62% of you agree. So we'll see where that goes moving forward. By the way, and obviously, the Open Streets Hamilton returns this year. So it's a great little pilot project that they can have and figure out, what they want to do with. It's change and it happens. So what do you do? I'm all in for that. All right. What else we got? Sheldon Keefe is out as coach of the. No way. I would have never thought. You're kidding me. Really? Young Sheldon is gone? Sent a real nice letter from some video from some lake somewhere, obviously already enjoying himself and thanking Leaf fans for the support over the years and all that sort of stuff as, the Leafs decide they are going to go in a different direction and are looking for a new head coach. I guess the big question is what happens next? What is the next shoe to drop? If in fact it is, I'm not sure this will be the last. Bank of Canada still very concerned about Canadian debt load due to higher interest rates. And although things are holding steady, it's still a concern what may happen down the road. Speaking of that, six of the largest industrial organizations in Canada have penned a letter to Chrystia Freeland and said the capital gains tax is very short-sighted and sows division within the country. You know, I've often said our prime minister is the most divisive prime minister. I mean, he separates people. Even though most of the people want vaccinations, he creates divisiveness there. You know, even though most Canadians are very concerned about climate change, it's his way or the highway. And if you don't believe in his way, carbon tax, you're a denier. So I believe it does sow division. It's surprising to hear that from an industrial organizations. But obviously, they're not for it. Says it makes Canadians less competitive, less innovative nation, and stymies economic growth and competition. So that's from the six largest industrial organizations. And I guess like building used to be a bad word, I guess now business is a bad word. Is that what we're moving towards? Remember, for the longest time, building was a bad word. We don't build because building extends the human footprint, and with that, it's bad for the climate. We haven't built for 20 years. That is the only reason we have the housing crunch that we do. If you don't build and you bring people in, what happens? Everything gets overloaded. So it's fascinating how with certain extremism politics that we've got to have an enemy. We can't make things work. And it seems that, you know, again, for the last 20 years, build was a bad word. Now business is a bad word. Because they're all the rich guys and, you know, forget about the jobs they provide or any sort of stability for the rest of us in the middle class, which I finally realized every time Justin Trudeau said anything about the middle class or those trying to join it, he was slowly dismantling it brick by brick until, well, the middle class can't afford a house. Enough said. We see what we see. All right, so, that's pretty much the big stuff that's going on. And as over the course of the afternoon, we'll talk about all of this, and including a new poll from Angus Reid. This gauges the popularity of all of the leaders of the political party, so NDP, Liberal, and Conservative. And new polling from Angus Reid says we hate them all. And I've said this a million times. When was the last time you went to the polls and you've said, oh, I got to have this person in. Oh, I'm absolutely in love with this person. And I know maybe some of you did that with Justin Trudeau because you like the hair.
I think most people do
it
with Stephen Harper probably.
Yes. No, I think it's quite the opposite where they go, anybody but that guy, anybody but that person, anybody but that candidate.
Oh, but the question is, Scott, how many people are now saying, is there a fourth option or a fifth option?
Well, if you want to split it even finer, yeah, go ahead. But in order to get a majority government, no, the more you split it, the smaller the pieces of the pie gets and the last chance of that actually happens. So at the end of the day, as I've always said, it's the best of a bad menu. It's the best of a bad menu. You know, you don't necessarily pick that person. It's just you don't want that one in there, or that one's been in too long. And, you know, as I've said many times, we vote left, then we vote right. We vote left, then we vote right. Then we vote left, then we vote right. And where does that leave the country? Hopefully in the center, which is something I think we've lost. So we'll talk about that. And despite Pierre Poilievre still the most popular winner or leader, and what's his name? Justin Trudeau being the last, and of course Jagmeet Singh in the middle, it still is traditionally incredibly low. People are not happy with any of these leaders. We'll have that discussion coming up a little later on. Well, it was announced today the Leafs have fired head coach Sheldon Keefe. To talk more about all of this, Ryan Kennedy is with us, senior writer with the Hockey News and Here Now. Ryan, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am. Thanks for having me.
So that didn't take long. Surprised, at least at the quickness of it all.
No, not particularly, especially because there are other coaches getting jobs. You know, we just saw Ottawa hire Travis Green the other day, too.
Hmm.
It's kind of morbidly funny how big this market is right now for coaches. You know, the turnover is incredible. More than half the league has been looking for a new coach in the past year. So it is a competitive market. And I think, for me, even coming into this season, if the Leafs didn't make a run at least to the conference final, Keefe was going to probably be on the way out, right?
Yeah.
He had a new GM in Brad Treliving, who was obviously going to assess Keefe, but ultimately, you know, this is a team that needs to take the next step, and they couldn't do it under Keefe.
So do you think this will be a quick decision for the Leafs, as quick as letting him go, or do you think they're going to take their time considering the market you just suggested?
Well, I think they already have probably a short list of candidates. You know, the name that everybody seems to be thinking of is Craig Berube, who, of course, won a Stanley Cup with the St. Louis Blues. And I would say that would be one of my top choices as well. I think Dean Evason, who had been coaching in Minnesota early in the year, he would probably be another top candidate that I would be looking at. So unless there's somebody still coaching in the playoffs that they're intrigued by, I wouldn't be surprised if we see a coach come in sooner than later, just because this did seem like a bit of a telegraphed move. You know, if we didn't make a run, we got to move on Keith.
What do they need that Sheldon Keefe couldn't provide?
I think it's just, you know, a voice with a little more authority.
Yeah.
Somebody that can kind of shake up that room, make sure that there's maximum accountability. You know, you think about teams that win and the culture that they have instilled.
Mm-hmm.
The Boston Bruins are the ones that I always bring up. And that's largely, you know, it's player driven going back to Zdeno Chara and Patrice Bergeron. But, you know, they've managed to find that culture in their room. And you look at teams that have success, you know, Tampa Bay and John Cooper, one of the few coaches that actually has tenure in the NHL right now. There's a reason John Cooper's been around as long as he has. And it's because he gets results. And I think Craig Berube is the type of coach that we have seen. You know, he can turn things around pretty quickly. And deliver a championship. And, you know, and he'll be honest with the players. And I think, you know, for a lot of the Maple Leafs, that's something that they need.
You know, it, every coach has their style, obviously, and I think a lot of people would agree with you on a little bit more aggression, but it would seem that Sheldon Keefe would stand back and kind of play the old coach and let the coaching staff handle it all. There wasn't a lot of emotional exchange between him and the players, and, you know, and we all know the issue with Marner throwing his gloves and how that all started and finished and such. It just didn't seem he had command of the bench.
Yeah, and you know what? I think, too, he seemed like the kind of guy that didn't make a lot of adjustments, whether, you know, during a series, and that would, you know, sort of kneecap the Leafs at different parts. When I think about Sheldon Keefe, you know, when he came in, he was obviously a first-time NHL coach.
Yeah.
He had won a Calder Cup championship with the Toronto Marlies, so this was the obvious next step. And it made sense at the time. You know, if you think about 5 years ago, guys like Matthews and Marner and even Nylander were still, you know, at the beginnings of their careers, and Keefe kind of grew with them. But I think there was a ceiling, much like when the Detroit Red Wings hired Jeff Blashill. You know, like with that one, I was like, they're never going to be a contender with Jeff Blashill, but he's the coach they need right now. You know, everybody growing together, getting to that next level. And then you have to go to somebody else that can sort of push you over the line. That's what they need right now, a coach that takes them to the next level. You know, the sort of thing we've seen with a Peter DeBoer or a Peter Laviolette.
More shoes to drop, management or players?
Maybe players. You know, when you ask the coach, you kind of give yourself a little more runway, and it says to the players, look, we couldn't fire all of you, so we fired this guy.
You could be next.
Yeah, exactly. So time to step up. And, you know, who knows how the players will react to whoever the new coach is. It might be a fantastic fit. In terms of management, I mean, I could see, you know, ownership moving on from Brendan Shanahan. But on the other hand, you have to think about all the off-ice components, right? I mean, Brad Treliving, this is his first year as GM. You're not going to move on from him. I thought he made some pretty good moves. If you look at Tyler Bertuzzi, that was a great signing for the playoffs. Even Joel Edmondson, I thought, was pretty good for them. But with Shanahan, you know, on the corporate side, he's very good. You know, he can be that face of the franchise where, you know, he can talk to the Bay Street Financial Club or whoever. You let Brad Treliving do the hockey stuff. But if ownership decides they want somebody else in that role, it's certainly been a long time without results. So I would get that. But I feel like, you know, Treliving's safe. And then, you know, with Keefe gone, whoever comes in, they might want different assistant coaches. Mm. So we'll have to see, you know, what happens there.
What about goaltending?
For me, you could bring Samsonov back, but with the understanding that he's Joseph Woll's backup. You know, goaltending is such a weird position, especially these days, right? Aiden Hill wins the Stanley Cup with Vegas. Jordan Binnington won it with St. Louis, came out of nowhere. I feel like Joseph Woll has a really good base and foundation to work with. He has NHL size, to be sure. He's shown he can be that guy to steal a game in the playoffs. So he has to be the guy getting 50, 55 starts next year. Samsonov as a backup, I think, is perfectly fine. And we've seen him play very well as well, but I don't think he's the guy that drives you through the playoffs.
Ryan Kennedy with us, senior writer for the Hockey News. The Leafs have fired head coach Sheldon Keefe. Ryan, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
I will. Thanks for having me.
All right, so we certainly know where the parties are polling, and the Prime Minister's not doing very well and quite low. Polyev's out in front. But the Angus Reid Institute, according to their new polling, the popularity of federal leaders in Canada is at its lowest level ever. So although the standings might be Polyev and then Jagmeet Singh and then the Prime Minister, they are lower than they've ever been for all three of all of the leaders like that. Let's bring in Dave Krasinski, Research Director with Angus Reid Institute, in here now. Dave, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Yeah, thank you. My Canucks came back and made it so that I was well last night.
There you go. All right. Good for you. Here. It's great. It's great to see two Canadian teams in the playoffs. That's for sure. All right. Good luck to you. So what does this say? I mean, we just hate them all. We don't like any of them. It's the best of a bad menu.
Yeah, it really, it's interesting when you go back and look at all of the data. It really makes you consider, you know, what the heck is happening right now? And I think with Trudeau, it's, you know, the attrition of being around too long. I think that he probably missed his opportunity to step out maybe 18 months ago or so, and really give the party, you know, a breath of fresh air. But the pre-Trudeau years were so tough that maybe he just figured he's the best chance. But he's down to 28%. That's his lowest rating that we have seen since he's been in office. So that's tough. And for Pierre Poilievre, you know, as I was writing this and going through all of the archival data, we find, you know, he started out at 51% unfavorable. So his negatives were twice what Stephen Harper's were when Harper took over. So he started in a position where people already had this kind of negative opinion of him because of some of the COVID stuff and the Freedom Convoy alignment and some of the positions he was taking that just aren't popular with a lot of Canadians enough to give you a 51% disapproval rate. And that's what he's at now. And Jagmeet Singh just seems to be being now dragged down by the Liberals and the fact that he's supporting them. You know, he was popular for quite a while because he wasn't a threat. And now people see him wielding some influence and they say, you know, I don't know if I like that guy right now either. So he's down to a minus 14 in our net ratings. So really just tough all the way around.
So so out of all of the ones we dislike, the prime minister's at the bottom, then Jagmeet Singh, then Pierre Poilievre. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So if you look at that, like I said, with that net rating, so you take their positives minus their negatives, and you've got Poilievre is a minus 12. Jagmeet Singh is a minus 14, and Trudeau is a minus 38. So Poilievre has kind of been in that area since he took over in kind of the mid-teens. Mm-hmm. But for Jagmeet Singh, it's a little new. And for Trudeau, it's just a little lower. We're trying to see, you know, how low he can go at this point because he's not turning around in what we're seeing.
What about the battle between Jagmeet Singh and the prime minister? Is that widening or is the prime minister dragging Jagmeet Singh down and the NDP?
Well, yeah, I think that what's happened is that as the Liberals have become, you know, so unpopular, you mentioned some of the vote intention polling. They're really it's looking pretty rough. You know, you see a lot of 40 to 23s in terms of the vote intention or 38, 22s. So the Liberal base is not large right now. And as Jagmeet Singh is kind of using this to get things across that his supporters like, he's maintaining a bit of that approval that he's had from NDP supporters, but that's not a very big group. Again, now we're only talking 23 to 25% of the voting population. So he might be getting something done for the 1 in 4 Canadians who support him, but he's kind of opened up to the ire of everybody else. So I think that his support of the Liberals has brought him down. If you look at his number, he went from, you know, plus 9 in 2020 to plus 6 to minus 1 to now minus 14 over the course of a number of years here. So it is trending downward, and this is the lowest that we've seen him so far, which was kind of the genesis for looking at all of this data going back 50 years.
Dave, could you see the NDP becoming the official opposition?
You know... It could happen, and the way that it could happen is there are still a number of older voters who are kind of supporting Trudeau and upholding his, you know, the respectability of the Liberal vote, you know, keeping him in the 22 to 25%. If Pierre Poilievre can convince older voters that he's not going to, you know, disassemble some of the social programs that a lot of older people rely on. You know, think about that 65 plus group and OAS and some of the spending programs that older voters tend to vote for. If he can convince that group that, yes, he's going to uphold those things and that we can get a, you know, a breath of fresh air and a new government here that can get some things done, then if that group leaves at the same rate that everybody else has left, you know, we're talking the sub 45 voters, then the NDP looks to be in a pretty good shape, actually, because old, younger voters have been switching over. And you only have to finish second, even if it's 20% and you beat 18% and get some more seats in the House. It could happen. So we'll see. That was what I took out of the budget, though, is that Trudeau's support among older voters is really hinging on a lot of popular items that involve spending. So that's going to be the line that Pierre Poilievre has to walk.
We traditionally vote, if you look back at the governments of the country, the left and the right, then the left and the right, then the left and the right, then the left and the right, and some, hopefully somewhere Canada ends up in the center. Do you still see that happening, or has it just become too divisive and extreme?
That's really something that shows up. You know, I'm looking at all of the data and watching leaders come and go, you know, throughout the 70s and 80s. So, you know, we're talking the early 80s. Pierre Elliott Trudeau becomes very unpopular. His approval rating goes underwater, gets a minus 34 rating. But along comes Brian Mulroney, and he takes a plus 33 rating. So Trudeau drops, Mulroney comes in. Right. What we don't have now that we've seen in all of these different iterations is somebody coming in and being, you know, an acceptable voice for people on the other side. So it does seem like the division is effective. And in our system, you just need to get to 40%. So I think that the leaders have looked at that and said, you know, the best way to do that is to really rally my base and then convince 8% of the electorate that the other guy is just, you can't go with him. You got to vote for me, even if you don't like it.
Right.
And that's what we've seen for, you know, two elections now, 5-6 years. So I expect more of the same.
Do you think with the leaders, all of them polling so low, even though they're in the same order that they were, do you think that will affect voter turnout?
It's going to be interesting. I'd have to look at that. I don't know what the data says about the negativity of elections, because, you know, oftentimes you get a big surge in voter turnout when you've got an inspiring choice. When you've got somebody like in the States, Barack Obama, you know, in 2015, young voters really did come out for Justin Trudeau. They liked his messaging.
Yep.
But that shine is gone. So we'll have to see. It did work in the United States last time. You know, we had a lot of people showed up to kind of, it was negative on both sides. It's going to be again this year. And I think that you can motivate people in that way by just saying, you know, I'm the lesser of the two evils or three evils in this case. So we'll see. But if I had to prognosticate, I think we're not going to break any records, but you might be in that low to mid 60s again, which, you know, it now constitutes a success in federal elections.
Dave Korsinski with us, research director with Angus Reid Institute. New polling from them. All of the leaders, lowest popularity ever. The order doesn't change, but we're not really liking any of them. Dave, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
No problem.
Let's go back 4.5 years, global pandemic. Boy, that was something. And the world post global pandemic, same thing. What an experience it has been. And many people now spending time looking back at where we were and how far we've come and how do we learn from this moving forward. We might remember one of the early vaccines way back when, AstraZeneca. Well, they have initiated the worldwide withdrawal of their COVID-19 vaccine because of a surplus of available updated vaccines. And as requested for it to be pulled, most countries have ceased using the shot back in 2021. This makes it official. Let's bring in Dr. Omar Khan, Assistant Professor, Institute of Biomedical Engineering and Department of Immunology, University of Toronto, and a Medicine by Design investigator here now. Doctor, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
Doing well. Thanks for asking.
Give us a little bit of history on this, how it all started, because we remember when we were struck with a global pandemic and nobody knew anything about this or a vaccine or anything to get us out of it. This was, I believe, the first. Give us a little backstory how it all got started.
Sure. When the pandemic started, there was this great need for a vaccine. So what a lot of countries and non-governmental organizations did was that they put in funding to try to develop different types of vaccines. They didn't know which one would come out first, or so they needed to place a couple of bets. And one of them was behind this AAV vaccine which is the AstraZeneca vaccine. And that one moved along a bit more quickly because it had already been in development for a different type of virus, but it was easily and quickly adapted towards COVID-19. So that's why it was one of the first ones to come up. And Oxford in the UK was really instrumental at helping bring this forward. And they had a lot of this manufacturing capability available. So it all worked out quite well. And it got deployed really quickly. And what was really important was that it was already out there starting to help people and prevent these kind of severe diseases that we were worried about.
Talk a little bit about that and its importance in those early days.
So in the early days, we were concerned for a few things. It was this severe disease. So people were getting COVID. And if you had a lot of these comorbidities, then some people ended up dying because of it. But others, they would get hit really hard. And they would end up, remember, in the ICU. And we had all these problems with compressed intensive care units where the hospitals were just filled. And we couldn't, they're over capacity. And this was one of the major problems we had. How do we prevent people from getting sick? And if you can't stop the infection, how do you make sure that they don't become so sick that they have to come to the hospital? Mm-hmm. And that's really where these vaccines were quite effective. They were effective at helping people avoid infection in the first place, but then mostly preventing you from getting to the point where you actually had to get to a hospital, which were overcrowded.
Yeah. Concerns over side effects or just the development of more advanced mRNA vaccines that eventually surpassed AstraZeneca?
Well, we have to acknowledge that some people did have adverse reactions specifically to this type of vaccine, types of clotting that resulted in people having long-term issues. And the estimated rate at which that happened was about 1 in 50,000. But, you know, it's still under investigation. But AstraZeneca has said that some people have been affected by this and they're looking at compensating those patients. So I think that's really responsible of them. That's really good. But other than that, for the most part, it was safe and it was effective. And in fact, one of the most important things that we did learn, surprisingly, was that if you had an AstraZeneca vaccine first, and then you got one of the mRNA vaccines after, your immune response was actually much better. So for those folks who had that two different types of vaccines, they ended up getting much, much better protection in the end. And that was something that was an important lesson for everybody going back and designing vaccines, trying to figure out how that happened and how we can replicate that safely and make even better vaccines in the future. So a lot of great things came out of this, not just protecting people.
Yeah, and remember the vaccine shopping that happened as the newer vaccines came into play. I remember my very first was AstraZeneca, then I believe it was a Pfizer, and then a Moderna. So I think I've had all three at one point. So obviously AstraZeneca has pulled off this off the shelves. It was sort of coming anyway. Where does that leave the other two, and Pfizer and Moderna and this whole vaccine moving forward?
Certainly their Pfizer and Moderna are still there. They're producing updates. The idea is that it potentially be seasonal if needed. And that's important. They found with the mRNA version and technology, it was very easy to update and keep it going. So that's important. That gives us continued coverage. So that's great. So we don't expect that to have any major changes. But what was also very important was that it showed that these mRNA vaccines were able to be used for other things. There are clinical trials now for flu. So the opportunity to get a flu plus a COVID all in one is actually really efficient, and that can get you all of your protection. And this also now reopens the door for what the mRNA vaccines were originally being developed for, things like HIV and other types of viruses. They've been in development for over 10 years now. So that's great to see all of these come together so we can have more vaccines against things that we've never had vaccines against.
There's the one positive to come out of all of this. Dr. Omar Khan with us, Assistant Professor, Institute of Biomedical Engineering and Department of Immunology, University of Toronto, and a Medicine by Design investigator. Doctor, I think we spoke several times over the last 4 years, and you were front and center, as many of your colleagues were. Thanks so much for the update. Much appreciated.
Thanks. Be safe, everybody.
Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer.
He'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson.
On Hamilton's News, Today's Talk.
900 CHML.
Fascinating article in the Post. Mark Carney says carbon tax served a purpose until now and calls for a credible alternative. Told senators that any new climate policy should not only be better and more effective than the carbon tax, but also have the power to drive investment. To talk more about all of this and what that all means, Dan McTagg with us, president of Canadians for Affordable Energy, former Liberal MP, and here now. Dan, thanks for the time. I hope you're well.
I am, and thanks for having me again, Scott.
What are your thoughts on the comments of the former Bank of Canada governor? What purpose did it serve until now?
Well, this is a fellow that has been, you know, one of the major promoters of net zero policy, of which there are many aspects, but most of them dealing with heavy burdens on industry, heavy burdens on energy, the energy sector, heavy burdens on consumers, and of course on a variety of business through a series of initiatives that are really designed to somehow make us feel better about the fact that there's less CO2. I won't get into the argument about CO2 not being a pollutant because grade four science will tell you that. Nevertheless, what Mr. Carney has done is basically said, hey, this isn't working. This is likely to lead to more and more people walking away from our net zero fantasies. So we're going to have to jettison at least the low-hanging fruit, the easy stuff. Let's get rid of the carbon tax. So let's focus on all the other stuff, which is just as damaging, just as costly. And, of course, a little bit of deathbed repentance, I believe. This is what this amounts to. And unfortunately, you know, this is a fellow that is in part the architect of all this stuff. And now he says, well, maybe it wasn't such a brilliant idea. I got a better idea. Maybe it'd be more brilliant if we stopped listening to people like him, who at the end of the day have done untold damage in their advice to restrict and divest from and getting banks to prevent any investments in energy, the energy sector, which, of course, the world desperately needs more of, especially Canadian energy.
So he says, Carney says it has served its purpose until now. What's different now? Why does it not serve its purpose moving forward?
You know, I had arguments with economists, green economists, climate economists, politicians of all stripes. We thought this is a wonderful idea and that there'd be no impact. But Scott, you and I have been talking about this for several years now, and I warned that this would hit and burden consumers and energy affordability, which is, of course, the organization which I've helped put together, Canadians for Affordable Energy, would eventually matter because it would drive up the cost of just about everything to intolerable levels. And it would see a divestment. It would see a fleeing of investments in Canada such that we have a weak Canadian dollar, which adds, you know, immeasurably to our lack of purchase power and the reason we feel that we're not getting ahead when it comes to buying the things we need to make ends meet. Mr. Carney, it may be late to the game, but he knew full well as a bright man, as did other economists and other former bank governors, that this is not the way to proceed. If you want to challenge the world to do a better job, apparently, on reducing carbon, and if you truly believe that is the way in which you go about it, the last thing you do is penalize a good country like Canada that's relatively clean, and you go after those nations that aren't, and nations that have traditionally said and turned a back on us and said, forget it, we're not going to be part of this. China, of course, being one, but there are many others. What Mr. Carney is doing here is perhaps a signal and telegraph that he has political interest, but unfortunately, he didn't listen at the beginning. He went ahead thinking there'd be no consequences for people. Everyone knows there's a problem. Everyone wants it gone.
He talks of a credible alternative that stimulates trade and commerce, drives investment, was his word. What would that be? What is his plan? Did he give any sort of indication?
Well, is it EV mandates where you spend $42 billion this week, another $5 billion next week, if I'm to take what Doug Ford has to say about another, get another announcement? Does it mean driving the Canadian loonie into the ground? Does it mean saying no to providing the world with Canada's menu of resources, oil and gas, natural gas in particular? I don't think he has any idea what he wants to do, but he knows that the only way ahead for Canada is to responsibly manage the resources which it has. And I think everything else, I think, is not just window dressing, but it's pie in the sky stuff. He got it spectacularly wrong on carbon taxes, as did most people who voted Liberal and NDP, thinking, hey, no problem. What's $170 a ton? We can afford this. Well, we're now at $65, $70 a ton, and we cannot afford it. Imagine having to now double this cost. And of course, there are other factors to this as well, because business now has to pay what's called an output-based pricing system, OBPS. And that's also a carbon tax on them to reduce their emissions, which, of course, is promptly passed on to consumers, or these businesses simply pack up, leave Canada behind, and do their business on the other side of the borders.
It's interesting because the Liberals will position the Conservatives as not having a plan, and let's hear what the plan is. I've confronted Pierre Poilievre on this show. He won't go into details about it, but he, you know, he basically talks about encouraging innovation and not putting it on the backs of the taxpayer, blah, 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 blah. It seems that the Liberals are pushing the Conservatives to hear what their policy is. Now it's almost as if other Liberals are questioning the Prime Minister to do a better version of what his alternative is. And Mark Carney's calling out for more alternatives from his own party, or as, you know, a part of the Liberal Party.
Well, the genie's out of the box. The net zero fantasy that I referred to, that everyone clings to, and which Mr. Carney and Bloomberg and many others are part of, really is a suicide note for the Canadian economy. And it is doing untold damage to the European economy right now. Its economy is in full recession. Don't take my word for it. Look what's happening in Germany, for instance. The reality is that all of these policies need to be shelved. We need to put them in perspective. I point out, by the way, the McDonnell Laurier Institute put out a great article today on electric vehicle mandates, forcing people to do these things. Enough of the forcing. Let's coerce. Let's not beat up. And I think that's the approach that the Conservatives would be well advised to take. But I am not, and I will make it very clear here, I am not going to put up with any politician of any stripe that doesn't start to talk about the menace, the elephant in the room, and that's net zero. You need to get rid of that because it has no purpose other than to enrich in grifters who made trillions of dollars around the world with nothing to prove except to make China more bold and more economically powerful.
Mark Carney says the carbon tax served its purpose until now, suggesting it's time for a credible alternative. Wonder if he's asked the Prime Minister about that. Dan McTagg with us, who was right, President of Canadians for Affordable Energy, former Liberal MP. Dan, thanks for the time. Be well.
Always a pleasure. Thanks again, Scott.
Don't go away. We're coming right back.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
A suspect in the killing of the Sikh activist out in British Columbia, one of the people arrested, reportedly got in on a student visa within days of application. To talk more about all of this, Christian Leprec, professor at both the Royal Military College of Canada and Queen's University, and a fellow at the McDonnell Laurier Institute, author of the new book, Security Cooperation Governance, the Canada-United States Open Border Paradox. Christian is with us now. Christian, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
You bet. Good afternoon, Scott. Nice to talk.
Christian, it seems like this is just another breach after breach, whether it's our security, intelligence, what have you, with this case in British Columbia. Is this all a result of the same problem we're seeing with election interference, Russia, and all of the rest? It's just we don't seem to have a handle on what's going on or who's coming and going.
Yeah, I mean, it's simple math, right? So you massively increase the number of people who come into the country, but there are no new resources for the enforcement agencies that are meant to do the security checks and to keep Canadians safe. And a significant influx is coming from countries where we have either low levels of cooperation with the local authorities, no levels of cooperation, or where we don't necessarily trust the documentation that we get from local authorities. And so if you don't have any additional resources, you have an excessive increase in demand, and you have that from sources where really you need to invest significantly more resources just to validate the information that you're getting, you can bet that this is not an isolated case. And so I see this as a canary in the coal mine, that there have been significant lapses in security vetting of people who've come into the country in recent years, and that these lapses are now enabling malign foreign actors to not just egregiously violate Canadian sovereignty, but put lives in this country at risk.
You bring up a valid point, Christian, and I'm not sure all Canadians understand this, or even the government, who, when you bring in 1.3 million people, new people per year for the last couple of years, everybody talks about housing and the stresses on healthcare and the stresses on everything, right down to shelter. Obviously, as you increase the population, you need to increase everything, including your intelligence, security, policing, that sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, So I think people forget that there's a full gamut of functions that a government needs to perform, and that, of course, one of the basic functions that we expect from a government is that in situations where, just like anybody who travels into this country, we expect that CBSA, you know, people have to fill in enhanced travel authorizations if you fly into this country, if you're not an American or Canadian citizen and the like. And so we expect the government to do its due diligence. But of course, the government set political goals for the number of people it wanted to bring into the country. And so that puts pressure on the agencies that clearly you're going to have to lower the level of screening on some of the individuals or people that raised flags that would have previously gone through a more thorough assessment. In that particular case, there's simply not the resources to do that. And so I think it's partially also naivety and benign that sort of the bulk of people come to this country come for perfectly good bona fide reasons.
Yep.
But we also need to assume that they're inherently going to be bad actors and that the federal government has an obligation. And arguably any government's first and foremost obligation is to keep citizens safe and secure.
So, obviously, a rapid increase in population screening will suffer as a result of the rapid increase. As you see more of this happening, as we're now getting reports from this case in British Columbia, that one suspect in the alleged killing or in the killing, came to the country very quickly on a student visa. Does that surprise you?
No, I mean, these visas are reasonably, I guess, straightforward to obtain. And ultimately, look, these are all political decisions, right? A government decides how many people it brings in. Governments decide under what visa categories they bring people in. And governments ultimately decide what level of screening people are ultimately subject to. Unless, of course, there's some blatant flag that sort of comes up in the screening that you already happen to be on some other country's watch list, security list, and the like. But we're also getting some hints, perhaps, here from the Indian government that either Canadian authorities didn't ask all the questions that they could or should have of Indian authorities and would have gotten more information if they had, or that perhaps Canadian authorities did ask some hard questions, did perhaps get back some intelligence that should have suggested, perhaps should have raised some flags, and that those flags ultimately weren't followed up with. And look, I mean, if anybody who's watched what's going on in the federal government in terms of intelligence flows between the agencies, the National Security Intelligence Advisor and Privy Council Office and the Prime Minister's Office knows that we have significant challenges with the intelligence information flows within the government when it comes to security intelligence. And so we shouldn't be surprised that we might also have problematic information flows when it comes to the assessment of visa applicants to this country.
The Toronto Star suggested yesterday the immigration system is flawed and needs rejigging. Is that accurate?
Look, I would reiterate that these are ultimately political decisions, especially when it comes to immigration and Immigration Canada. These have been longstanding political decisions on the number of immigrants, how they get vetted, what visa categories they get admitted under. If the system is flawed, that would ultimately be, I guess, a decision that Canadians will have to make at the ballot box. And I suppose that different political parties will need to put up an alternative to the choice that the current federal government has made. I think what the tragedy out of this is that as a result of recent decisions by the current government, we've seen a significant drop in the tolerance by Canadians for immigration. Immigration in this country had been the gold standard of the global system. And I think what's tragic is that this case will reinforce the declining legitimacy of the immigration system in Canada and the consensus that for decades Canadians had forged around immigration.
Christian Leprecq with us, professor, both Royal Military College of Canada and Queen's University, fellow at the MacDonald Laurier Institute. Christian, as always, thanks so much for the time. Be well.
Thank you. Have a good afternoon.
We all know what it's like dealing with affordability issues of late, specifically around groceries and all of the commotion and publicity that the major grocers have got, especially as profits rise, and a Loblaw ban. We look at consumer psychology with the Loblaw ban with Professor Eugene Chan, who recently covered the issue in an article for The Conversation. The headline is Loblaw's Boycott, What Consumer Psychology Can Tell Us About the Success of Consumer Activism. And to talk more about all of this, Professor of Marketing from Toronto Metropolitan University, Eugene Chan. Eugene, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
Thank you. Good afternoon to you.
So, first of all, how do these things start? How does this momentum grow?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's a very interesting question. It's an important question because boycotts usually start, or at least protests usually start, when a brand or a company is doing something wrong or is even perceived to be doing something wrong. So they might not actually be doing something wrong in reality, but just a perception of doing something wrong.
And does something such as a boycott, does it work? When does it? When doesn't it?
Yeah, so, I mean, history has shown that some boycotts work and some boycotts don't. In this case, in the Loblaw case, it's clear that the boycott organizers are, I mean, there's public frustration on social media and on websites, and it's gaining traction. So it is doing something, and it's also eliciting the response from Loblaw CEO per bank. You know, they're trying to, you know, argue against the boycott's claims by basically saying that the high food prices are due to supply chain issues.
So you bring up an interesting point, Eugene. How should or how is the grocery companies, whether it's Loblaw's, reacting to this? Could they be doing more to open up the lines of communication between them and their customers?
So one way that brands and companies can respond is by basically giving evidence or proof, or by like basically giving facts to you know, back up their own views or their own their own claims. So in this case, Loblaws and other supermarkets really need to provide evidence that supply chain increases are to blame for the high food prices. It's not so good to attack the boycott organizers or plan protests. For instance, you know, the CEO is issuing statements saying that enough is enough, or that the criticisms are misguided. And I can understand their frustration on their part, but that's not really the ideal way of tackling this boycott issue.
It doesn't look like they've really handled the PR aspect of that as they should. Is that because it's not really a priority for them?
It's certainly a priority. I mean, because they do see that there is public frustration on social media, there's public venting, and these obviously boycotts. It is going to hurt the bottom line. So, like, down the road, eventually, they will, Loblaws and other supermarkets will have to really respond effectively. But, like, right now, yes, I can say that they could be doing a bit better.
Is this a very small but very vocal group of a percentage of people, customers, but on social media it appears bigger than it is, and, you know, this provides something, someone to lash out at? Or is it something that starts small and then grows?
Both. I mean, both can be true. It's certainly small right now. There is the boycotts, the public venting on social media and websites. It's really right now still a minority view, a minority viewpoint. There are people who do like Loblaws, whether it's because it's convenient or for their food selection or grocery selection. But, you know, eventually, as this boycott or the planned protests really start, you know, evolving and attracting attention, it will definitely grow, and it will obviously require a more effective PR campaign on Loblaws' part.
What will make this boycott a success? How long does it have to go? Is it petering out? Is it gaining steam? What will make it a success?
It's certainly gaining steam. It might not be affecting the bottom line for Loblaws too much right now. For instance, like, we see that Loblaws, their profits are rising and their stock prices are rising. But, you know, over time, as the boycotts and the organizers really start attracting public attention and gaining traction, not just, you know, in the GTA or the Hamilton area, but across Canada, this is something that will hurt Loblaws eventually, if not just financially, but at least on a reputational level.
We've talked to some experts who've echoed what you've said, Eugene, that a lot of this is between the suppliers and the grocers, which, again, gets pretty deep into the weeds for the average consumer. Can they explain the whole supplier-grocer relationship and make us understand it, or allow us to understand it?
That's a difficult challenge for Loblaws. You know, what is supply chain? Like we've heard consumers, everyday consumers, like they hear these terms, but they don't know exactly what the issues are and what's driving the high food prices. And so in order for Loblaws' response to the boycotts or to be effective, they really need to educate, like form an educational campaign about the reasons, about the factual reasons behind the high food prices.
Do you think others will learn from this ban? They're sort of staying under the radar right now.
Yes, that's certainly true. I mean, the other major supermarkets in the country, they're remaining silent. My guess is that they're taking a step back by kind of seeing how the response, how Loblaws' response, how they're affecting the boycotts before they themselves actually step in and, and mount their own PR campaigns.
Eugene Chan with his associate professor, marketing, Toronto Metropolitan University. The latest in the conversation, Loblaws ban, do these sorts of things work? Eugene, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thank you so much.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson.
On Hamilton's News, Today's Talk.
900 CHML.
The Canadian Federation of Independent Business and several other business groups have teamed up to call for Chrystia Freeland's capital gains tax to be scrapped. You might remember this was in Justin Trudeau's federal budget rollout that lasted about 2 to 3 weeks. The headline in the Toronto Star, Chrystia Freeland's capital gains tax hike is short-sighted and must be scrapped, business groups charge. Some major business lobby groups are banding together to denounce the federal government's proposed increase to the capital gains taxes, calling it short-sighted and divisive and will hamper economic growth. To talk more about all of this, Dan Kelly with us, president of the Canadian Federation of Independent Business. And here now, Dan, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Yeah, I'm good to be with you.
So, Dan, I guess it's not surprising to hear business groups saying that this makes Canada less competitive, a less innovative nation. It stymies competition and economic growth. But it's kind of interesting to hear business organizations say that it will sow divisiveness. How do you take that?
Well, look, one of the major planks of this package is the so-called Tax the Rich campaign, suggesting that those that have capital gains are somehow the wealthy fat cats of the nation and that more from them is needed in order to provide services to the rest of us. But I think that comes from a real misunderstanding of why capital gains are so important to entrepreneurs, not just for the rewards of the business for a business owner, but also to help protect a business from economic downturns. In fact, there's a whole bunch of small businesses that when they really couldn't rely on returns from the market because they were closed during the pandemic, they relied on other forms of income, whether that was rental property or investment portfolio. And that's what kept the business afloat over the last number of years. And I think Ottawa's lost sight of that.
As you mentioned, when this was presented, it's all about taxing the rich. It's even going to be a separate part of the budget, so it'll have to be magnified and voted to. The reason behind that is thinking that, what party is going to vote against taxing the rich? But as you pointed out, it seems to affect the middle class as well. How does it affect the middle class? How does it trickle down to them, to us?
Yeah, for small business owners, there are two pieces that really do affect that affect them from a capital gains perspective. One, it's the sale of the business itself. And on that front, there are some winners, not just losers from this package. The government, in addition to raising the capital gains inclusion rate to 67%, they also bumped up the amount of money a business owner, when they sell their business, can have tax-free. And they put in place another thing called the Canadian Entrepreneurs Incentive that provides lower capital gains exemption, lower capital gains taxes on another chunk of income. But the increase to 67%, if your business is worth more than a few million dollars, that's going to bite. On top of that, any capital gain within the corporation itself. So if your company has an extra building or owns part of a strip mall or an investment portfolio, that money is going to be taxed, all of it, at 67%. There's no $250,000 amount at the existing rate like there is for individuals. And it's that money that many business owners are counting on as their rainy day fund or to help in, like, for example, with doctors, to count on for their own retirement. So, yeah, these are some of the concerns we're hearing from small business owners and then from individuals. You know, yes, it's true. Most Canadians don't have a whole bunch of capital gains annually. But they do
But many do kind of once in a generation. They might have that cottage that was left to them, or they might have a second property that they bought to pay for their retirement. And now all of that is going to be taxed, or much of that is going to be taxed at a much higher rate, because typically those things sell for more than $250,000.
We've heard that Chrystie Freeland, obviously voting this as a separate element outside of the budget, the capital gains tax increase. Is that a sign that they may be reconsidering this or walking this back, carving out?
Yeah, there's two ways to look at that. That's the optimistic view, that they're carving it out because they know that there's going to be either some major amendments or possibly even an exit ramp altogether. And I sure want to believe that. But the other view of that is that they're, you know, that the purpose of this was to lock the Tories into voting against that, so that this can be the major theme in the election. You know, to make tax changes basically a prop for a political campaign, that's pretty terrible. And I do worry about the message that like right now, business owners and I think some members of the public are panicked trying to figure out what these changes mean. We don't even have draft legislation to understand if these changes pass, what people should do. And so we're getting a ton of business owners freaking out saying, okay, should I sell now? Should I try to, what strategy should I embark on right this minute with really a time running out? It's till June 25th they have to make some pretty important life decisions about them for themselves and for their business. That's really inappropriate. And the fact that for whatever reason is driving the government's refusal to put forward the actual draft legislation and all the rules associated with it, it's having real world, real life consequences. And that's just wrong.
How much weight does this letter have? How much weight does this group of businesses organizations have?
Well, look, I hope that the government does pay close attention. They have on a few other fights. My organization, CFIB, banded together with a few other associations during the big small business tax fight of 2017. The federal government scaled back its initiatives by at least 50%. In addition to that, after they upset so many small business people, they ended up lowering the small business corporate tax rate by 2 points, really as a kiss and make up strategy at the end of that. So hopefully the federal government will once again realize that it's making some big mistakes by rushing through a package of this magnitude, and they'll scale it back, possibly even delay the whole thing. And that's what we're calling on Ottawa to do. We think there are some pieces of this, to be clear, that we like, but we need a little bit of time, for goodness sakes, for governments to make sure that the policies aren't going to have pretty terrible unintended consequences. And that's what we expect will happen if they steamroll this ahead.
Several business groups have teamed up to call for Chrystie Freeland's capital gains tax plan to be scrapped. Dan Kelly with us, president of the Canadian Federation of Independent Business. Dan, thanks for the time. Be well.
Anytime.
Mossab Hassan Youssef, the son of Hamas, the estranged eldest son of Hamas co-founder, recently spoke at an event organized by the Jewish Federation of Greater Vancouver, warning that the terror group needs to be destroyed. Our guest also attended the event, gave some remarks, and was part of a panel discussion. Dr. Rahim Mohammed with us, political commentator and writer specializing in comparative politics, natural resources, and the political economy, former professor with the with Center College and Wake Forest University, and with us now, Dr. Rahim Mohammed. Thanks for the time. Hope you're doing well.
Always a pleasure, Scott.
What was the message that you heard to the Jewish Federation of Greater Vancouver?
So Masab's message is very clear, and I would recommend your listeners check out his videos on YouTube and the like. It's, you know, knowing Hamas from the inside, you know, being a prince, really, of Hamas, and a strange prince of Hamas. Hamas is not a liberation movement. It is a terror movement. Its message is not one of liberation or peace. It is one of destruction. And it is one for the Palestinian people, to have any hope of a brighter future. It's an entity that will need to be destroyed and demobilized.
How do Palestinians separate themselves from Hamas?
I think it's very challenging to. Obviously, Gaza has been under Hamas control for over a decade. There is a substantial amount of intimidation that goes on. So Hamas actually, as Masab wrote about extensively in his 2010 book, hasn't hesitated to use physical coercion, torture against its fellow Palestinians. So even Palestinians that are frustrated with Hamas, that are becoming disenchanted with Hamas, it's very challenging for them to speak out, given, you know, given the environment of terror and intimidation that's taken hold of Gaza and to a lesser extent the West Bank. So I think a lot of it relies on members of the diaspora, like Masab himself, to tell their stories in a place where it's safe for them to do so and they can get their message out.
Yeah. Is that message getting to the protests we're seeing in North American cities, on college, in college encampments, whatever? Is that message getting to the people, or do they understand that, who are protesting?
Unfortunately, it is being drowned out. So Masab's remarks, interestingly enough, they came just days after an organizer, an international coordinator for Samadun, Charlotte Cates. You know, she gave a speech on the steps of Vancouver Art Gallery, calling on the federal government to delist Hamas as a terrorist organization. So I think, unfortunately, that message is getting muddled. It's not getting through to the college campuses. It's not getting through to the college students in kafias, and at some point, and in some cases, Hamas headbands, you know, that need to hear it. And unfortunately, you know, that's sort of where we are in the current communication environment.
We certainly, everybody who from any civilization or modern civilization knows the destruction of war, the collateral damage, the horrific tragedy that can ensue after or during conflict of this time, and feel sorry and terrible, of course, for the people who are suffering in this. But how can you protest for that and not understand that behind this is a terrorist organization, and it's a lot greater than just coming up with a peace plan? There has to be some sort of governing body put in there when this all settles down.
Yeah, so I would, to any young people out there, to any people that are taking part in the pro-Palestinian pro-protest, you know, I've seen the same images you have from Gaza, and it is horrific. It is, these are very disturbing scenes, particularly when it involves children, when it involves civilians. But at the same time, I would urge you to reflect critically on the sorts of slogans that you're chanting nowadays. So things like "From the River to the Sea," you know, things like "Free Palestine." What exactly would a Palestinian state under Hamas control? And there's really no other entity organized enough to establish a governance over over Palestine, a free Palestine. What would that look like? And would that be better than, you know, what Israel looks like today for its, you know, for all its goods and bads, for both Arabs and for both Arabs and Israelis? You know, would a Hamas-controlled Palestine lead to a better quality of life for the people in the region, including the Arabs in the region? So about 2 million of Israel citizens who vote in elections, you know, who are part of political parties, who are part of the judiciary, who are police officers, are Arabs. So what exactly would that look like if Israel's government was supplanted by a, you know, Hamas-controlled governing apparatus? Would that be a better life for the people in the region, including the Arabs in the region? I would urge young people to reflect critically on that question.
And the obvious answer would be no. Are neighboring countries, nations around the Gaza Strip helping Palestinians?
I would say no. I think more often than not, you're seeing countries quietly help Israel. So Jordan was sort of forced to show its hand a few weeks back during the Iranian rocket attack against targeting sites in Israel. Obviously, the one outlier at this point is Iran. So Iran is bankrolling not only a lot of Hamas's terror activities, yeah, but a lot of the belligerent activities of allied groups like Hezbollah in southern Lebanon and the Houthi movement, which is based in Yemen. So Iran right now is the big outlier. I am a proponent of, you know, putting the strongest regime of sanctions possible on Iran to cripple its ability to sustain financial ecosystem of terror, you know, that you see permeating the region.
Who governs Gaza when if Hamas is removed? How do you destroy Hamas with minimal collateral damage to Palestinians?
So I think that is the challenging question. I think there would have to be some sort of provisional authority And you'd have a situation where you would need, I don't know if I like the word occupation, but you'd need an Israeli military presence, you know, while the governance structure is, you know, has time to develop and has time to build legitimacy. And I think that that's obviously that indicates that, you know, even if we're reaching the end, hopefully, of the direct hostilities between Israel and Hamas, this is likely going to be a much longer term, years long, a process of restoring governance and restoring legitimacy to any sort of governance structure in Gaza. So I can't give you a direct answer, but I think that's a good question. And that's a question we should be answering right now,
Why aren't those neighboring countries or nations taking in Palestinians who are fleeing the conflict?
Yeah, so I think people a lot of the time forget that there is a direct border between Gaza and Egypt. I think one, you know, Hamas is not particularly friendly to those regimes as well. And two, I think those countries would, you know, don't want to be seen as complicit in the ethnic cleansing. I'm putting that in quotation marks of the Arab population from Gaza. So I think it is a challenging question, and it does create a political conundrum for countries like Egypt and Jordan that are neighboring countries, but have a stake in maintaining sizable Arab populations in areas like Gaza and West Bank.
Is it accurate that Palestinians need to separate themselves and make that separation known in order to attain the success they're looking for?
Separate themselves from Israel or separate themselves from, I'm sorry, I don't totally understand.
Separate themselves from Hamas.
Separate themselves from Hamas. You know, I think it's a matter right now of organizationally dismantling Hamas. And I think once that happens, you're not exactly going to see Palestinians greet Israel as liberators. But I think you're going to see a more open expression of sentiments that sort of go against the MO of Hamas. And I think right now the focus should be on demobilizing Hamas's military and administrative capabilities. And obviously the hard work comes later. And I can't give you an exact, you know, blow-by-blow projection of how that's all going to play out. But the immediate objective for now should be the mobilization of Hamas's offensive capabilities.
Dr. Raheem Mohammed with us, political commentator, writer specializing in comparative politics, natural resources, and political economy, former professor of Center College and Wake Forest University. Raheem, thanks so much for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thanks for having me.
Very excited over the announcement of the Biebers that there's going to be a Bieber baby on the way is Scott Radley, host of the Scott Radley Show, coming up after the 6 o'clock news. You can read him in your Spectator. Scott, how are you today?
Would that be a Bieblet?
A Bieblet.
Not sure.
Is that like a Timbit or?
Kind of, yeah. Well, he did his Tim Hortons thing, so he, you know, there could be tied into that. They could, yeah, little Bieblets.
A Bieblet.
Yeah.
How long did it take for you to think of Bieblet?
Well, as long as I had no idea about it till you mentioned it as we were coming on, so it took that long.
So, is that a name for? Because Tom said you might have some names for the Bieber baby.
I didn't
know you were just going to call it something.
Well, I mean, we call him the Biebs, right? So why not? Why wouldn't the baby have a little, you know, name like a, you know? Well, what do you? I mean,
Biebs baby.
The quiz question the other night on my show. We do a quiz every night for those who don't know. Was what do you call a baby kangaroo? Which was a Joey, right?
Yes.
And so a baby Bieber. We have a Bieblet or a. We can think of something else if we give it enough time.
I didn't know you were sort of going to, I thought you were looking to name it, characterize it as something, as if it's somehow Bieber's baby is different from other children.
Yeah, this somehow got into like a scientific discussion.
Clearly.
Here.
Exactly.
Clearly, Justin Bieber is beyond the rest of us mere mortals. And so his child, you know, has obviously got its own little category. Yes. But I will leave the naming. I think we should probably allow them to name their child. That would be respectful.
All right, so that went pretty quick. All right, so, and do you want to add any more to the Bieber baby?
You know, it's really nothing that I'm just amazed that, well, you know what, we'll leave everything there.
You want to keep digging yourself a hole here, Scott, or, you know?
See,
I still think of Justin Bieber because I still think of Justin Bieber as like a 12-year-old. So I have to keep reminding myself that he is now, what, 28, 29, something like that. So it's,
Did he reach adolescence? How does that happen?
As I say, it's just I don't give a lot of thought to Justin Bieber in my day-to-day life. It's just not something that I...
It would appear that you do.
This is as much as I have thought about Justin Bieber. The last time I gave this much thought to Justin Bieber was at the 100th Grey Cup when he was doing the halftime show. That is my lone Biebish experience.
All right. The thoughts on, let's move on from the Biebs and the babies and stuff. Sheldon Keefe fired as Leafs head coach. Obviously not a lot of surprise there. Your thoughts?
No surprise there. I'm... You know, did you see the video that he put out today?
Yes, with the lake in the background.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like obviously up at the cottage somewhere by now. He's done.
Yeah, and look, I thought it was a very classy video. And
yeah, I thought so.
That him saying, you know, it's my fault. I couldn't get us over the hump in the playoffs. That's my job. So it falls on me, and thus I failed, and therefore I get it. You know, I'm not positive, though. No coach is perfect. Sheldon Keefe is certainly not perfect. He has shortcomings. But I am not convinced that when you just bring in somebody else, the problems all go away. I'm not convinced that this is a Sheldon Keefe problem entirely, the fact that they've had this playoff failure. We will see. I could be wrong. We could find out next year that a new voice behind the bench and in the dressing room, they go on a long run and win the Stanley Cup. Who knows? But I it's a personnel and a team construction and a philosophical how you build a team thing that comes from people way above him even, and the guys on the ice. And so, I know you have to do something. You're the Leafs. The fans are screaming for change, and justifiably so. I just don't know. I mean, he's a guy who's taking it with class. I just don't know if he's the answer.
Did he have command behind the bench? Was he passionate enough behind the bench? Did he have control of the players on the bench?
Well, I mean, look, it depends on, we don't know all the personalities of those guys in the dressing room because we're not in the dressing room to spend time with them. And so, you know, remember when Mike Babcock was there, they were all complaining that he was mean, he was hard on us. And so they went out and got a player's coach. And certainly the players have responded in so far as they've had great regular seasons. It's a playoff thing where they have fallen apart. And so, could that be Sheldon Keefe? Yeah, I mean, it could. But could it also be that, you know, okay, you've had how many, I don't know if I remember, what is it now with this group, six playoff runs with Tavares and Marner and Matthews?
I think they're mature now.
At some point, even if the coach is not doing everything you want, at some point, would the players not just take over on the ice and perform well enough to get you over the hump? At some point, this has to fall on the players and on a specific group of players, because there's five of them that have been there as a constant while everything around them keeps changing. We tinker, they tinker. We try to make new wingers, a new defenseman, a new this, new that. But the Riley, Tavares, Marner, Matthews, Nylander have been there the whole time, and they are the constant, and they are the ones that don't get over the hump. Somehow, maybe what I would have loved to have heard, and I know we got to go, what I would have loved dearly to have heard is what Sheldon Keefe just said as a man standing up and saying, I didn't do what I was supposed to do. This is on me. I would have loved to have heard one of the Maple Leaf players of that five, when they had their media day, say, I wasn't good enough. I should have been better. I could have done more for this team. And yet none of them say anything remotely like that. So I applaud Sheldon Keefe for having class on the way out. And I look at those guys and say, maybe that's why you're losing.
All right, Scott Radley, coming up after the 6 o'clock news. Read them in your Hamilton Spectator. Thank you, Scott. Have a great show.
See ya.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, we leave it to you, the taxpaying customer, to have the last word. This one via text from Bud. Ducks and geese have been causing traffic jams on highways for years, with police and transportation ministry personnel trying to ensure their safety. Does the phrase herding cats come to mind? Bud, keep right except to pass.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.